in southern Jordan witnessed strikes to protests because of the rise of fuel prices, starting with truck drivers last week, leading to the closure of markets and shops, with a shocking twist of 3 police officers being murdered and 5 other wounded during a raid which was targeted actually to stop a suspect who supposedly killed one of the deputy police chief of the Southern Ma'an governorates. Now, protests are still underway, but how much are the truck driver protests related to the armed clash that saw the killing of 3 police officers?
Well, thank you, Marwa, for having me here. Well, these protests, in a way, they are related. However, you know, normally protests, strikes takes place in Jordan. As protests, you know, rights to protest, rights to strikes are granted, you know, in a Jordanian constitution. And we have witnessed, you know, occasionally, you know, strikes, protests, I mean, particularly in the last few years. I mean, if you would speak of what you so-called Arab Spring since 2011, we have witnessed, you know, I would say a number of protests, strikes, where people went to the streets and expressed freely. These protests are legitimate as long as they are peaceful, pacific in that sense. And if you would go back to 2018, there were major strikes, you know, that brought down, you know, the government, which was replaced later on in that sense. However, what's different related to these strikes, you know, normally strikes and the protests, there is this potentiality they could lead to chaos. You know, they would be exploited by certain outlaws, radicals in that sense. And this is what happened, actually. And this was what happened last time in that sense, which led to violence and where police officers were targeted later on. Of course, you know, it was revealed by outlaws and by radicals who took the opportunity, who exploited, you know, peaceful strikes, and things developed to the point where, you know, there was this fear it could escalate to sort of armed clashes. However, the Jordanian relevant agencies, law enforcement agencies, of course, intervened and somehow managed to neutralize those outlaws and that and those radicals in that sense. However, the government continued to negotiate with the truck drivers or haulers in that sense. And from my perspective, although the problem has not finished yet, in the sense, you know, those reasons that led to the strike strikes are still there. However, probably the killing of Colonel Abdelabih and later on, you know, the clashes with the police probably established a turning point in the sense people, to be honest, become afraid that, you know, these developments could lead to unthinkable violence in that sense.
We did see at the same time, Professor Momani, that the level of criticism and the fiery speeches, maybe satirizing speeches as well against the government of Dr. Bashir al-Kassouni rising. And there are still rumors that the government is expected to maybe departure in Jordan. Will that be enough this time to put a hold on popular protests if the king comes out to dissolve the government? Is that enough to stop the protests?
Well, criticism, you know, part of Jordan politics. It's part of Jordan norm, to be honest. I mean, each and every prime minister would be subject to criticism in that sense. And this is normal. I mean, I would claim easily that there is this relative level of expression, you know, in media, people would, you know, criticize governments, ministers, and so on and so forth in that respect. However, you know, dissolving the government, from my perspective, would not end the problem in that sense. You know, when it comes to Jordan economy has always suffered from deeply rooted structural problems. You speak of scarcity of natural resources. You speak of sometimes mismanagement, misjudgments in that respect. Also, not to mention, which is probably the most important factor, Jordan is situated in a harsh environment. And as you know, in the last few years, you know, instability has been the order of the day when it comes to the region, which generated multiple challenges to Jordan. You speak of millions of refugees came to Jordan. You speak of recent developments at the regional and the global level. I mean, you speak of COVID-19, you speak of war in Ukraine, which disrupted energy markets, was disrupted food chains. All of that actually exacerbated Jordanian economy, which is already suffering in that respect. However, you know, in the last year or since a year, there has been this modernization process. The king, along with the you know, social and political groups in Jordan, launched what you can call it a modernization process at all levels, economic, political, and administrative. And recommendations were presented, approved, confirmed by the parliament and other government agencies in that respect. And supposedly, the current government would start delivering, would start carrying out those recommendations in terms of reforming the political aspect, in terms of reforming the Jordanian economy. I mean, in the last few months, there have been a sort of constitutional amendments. New laws were introduced, electoral law, political parties laws in that respect. And there is this 10-year plan for economic reform and reforming Jordanian public sector.
It seems that the protesters are not on the same line with what the government is doing, hence why they are a bit infuriated. But I've heard a lot, I've read a lot as well on the Jordanian media about certain Zionist activity and networks with various masks in having a hand in escalating the economic crisis in Jordan. What can you tell us about this? In what ways could the Israelis have a hand to try and manipulate the Jordanian economy?
I mean, you know, the issue of Israel, the issue of Arab-Israeli conflict, in particular the Palestinian question, has always generated multiple challenges to Jordan in that respect, security, economic, and so on and so forth. Jordan is the party that is most close to the Palestinian question. We speak of economic burden, we speak of millions of Palestinian refugees here, the absence of peace. I mean, I would say between the Palestinians and Israelis also continued to be a sort of a burden on Jordan in that respect. So in one way or another, Israel is a factor in that respect. You know, the continuation of Israeli occupation to the Palestinian territories, Israeli measures of provocations and against the Palestinians definitely impacting Jordan in that respect. Now, when it comes to this sort of conspiracy theory, whether Israel is, you know, manipulating or having, you know, a hidden hand in such difficulties, I would say Israel is a detrimental factor when it comes, I mean, to occupation, when it comes to those multiple challenges that have been generated by the Arab-Israeli conflict, in particular, Palestinian question.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hassan Al-Mumani, Professor of International Relations and Conflict Resolution at the University of Jordan, for giving us your time to explain what's actually going on in Jordan. Thank you very much for your contribution. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the non-existent peace in Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
It's It seems that the situation in Yemen is heading towards a renewed military escalation, whose chances increased as the Qatar World Cup came to an end, which, among other factors, contributed to preventing the collapse of the calm based on undisclosed understandings between the parties to the conflict. Among what indicates this trend is the affirmation of the Supreme Political Council in Sana'a during its last meeting that the state of no war and no peace that Yemen has been experiencing since the end of the armistice last October and the lack of agreement on its extension will not last long. More details in the following report.
The Supreme Political Council in Sana'a confirmed during its last meeting that the state of no war, no peace in Yemen will not last. The Supreme Political Council then vowed to take the necessary measures in a timely manner to end the situation where the Saudi-Emirati coalition aims to keep Yemen in its circle while trying to make it possible for regional and international efforts to establish peace. As it hinted at the faltering of all previous Omani endeavors for peace, the Supreme Political Council warned against the consequences of Sana'a's impatience, stressing that any steps that the Saudi-led aggression takes will be met with a response and that the consequences will be dire. The Council's statement represents a clear indication that the understandings between Sana'a and the countries of aggression through regional and international mediations have reached a dead end. Sana'a gave peace efforts a wide margin during the period following the end of the armistice and made moderate concessions, hoping to make progress that would end the suffering of the state employees by agreeing to pay their salaries and alleviate the siege experienced by the Yemenis by opening the port of Hodeidah and Sana'a's airport. The leadership in Sana'a has become convinced that there are no real intentions to stop the aggression and lift the blockade. Considering that the statement of the Supreme Council was issued one day after the end of the World Cup activities, makes it highly likely that the confrontations in Yemen are close. These warnings coincided with indications of a return to military escalation, including the payment of new arms shipments to the militias loyal to the Saudi-led coalition in the southern governorates, especially those whose members belong to the extremist Salafist movement on the fronts of the Adalia and Al-Baida. In addition to continuing arrangements for handing over the military file in Ma'rib to forces loyal to the UAE. Likewise, during the past 2 days, ceasefire violations escalated, especially on the southern fronts of Hodeidah, in parallel with the intensification of surveillance and offensive drones, and the increase in the number of cases of maritime piracy on fuel supplies arriving at the port of Hodeidah. Moreover, intel sources in Sana'a revealed a Saudi plan to provide forces loyal to the coalition with bomber drones operated from Yemeni airports outside Sana'a's control as an alternative air cover to that provided by the kingdom. According to these sources, Riyadh, based on the new plan, will not participate in any direct air operations to try and avoid Ansarullah targeting oil and vital facilities inside the kingdom, hence making Riyadh's role a limited one while providing support and assistance to the ground forces loyal to it.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammed Obaid, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us. Mr. Mohammed, now the Supreme Political Council made it clear in Sana'a that the capital's demands, they must be met, and it will not stand by without responding to the blockade, while also warning that any upcoming military round with Saudi Arabia will be different from all previous ones. In what ways will it be different? I mean, what kind of surprises does Yemen have in its pocket for the Saudis?
Well, first, thank you for having me. The issue is that you have the aggression countries, basically Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and you have them preparing all the time. That's why they requested the armistice in the first place, in order to launch more aggressions. This is what is the case, and this is what will happen if the Yemeni legal government, the legitimate government in Sana'a, is not ready, is not well prepared at the military level, at all other levels, politically and otherwise, in order to prevent such an aggression. We've seen a military parade a few weeks ago by the Yemeni government in Sana'a, as if they were telling them that the forthcoming battle, if it happens, is going to be very different from the previous ones. The aggression countries, basically Saudi Arabia and UAE, have been using the time in order to take some more measures, trying to be sly or cunning as for not using their own forces, their militias, in the forthcoming battle, if it happens. So every party of the conflict is now as if showing a little bit of their cards in order, basically, sometimes maybe to prevent the situation from escalating even further.
But if that's the case, if the case that these parties want to prevent the escalation, why is that we have intel sources from Sana'a revealing a Saudi plan to provide forces on the ground, mercenaries that are actually, their allegiance is for Riyadh, they want to provide them with drones because Riyadh has made it clear that it does not want to participate in any direct air operations to try and avoid any Ansarullah targeting of its oil and vital facilities. But do you think that this plan has a prospect of success, given that Sana'a actually views this sovereign government as an extension of the Saudi coalition of aggression against the entire country?
Well, per se, this basic piece of information is also an indication of the weakness of the aggression countries, basically Saudi Arabia. They're they're being not ready to take more strikes by the Yemeni forces, as for in oil fields or in against any other facilities in Saudi Arabia. So that's why they are trying to avoid this by putting in the front line the militias that are loyal to them in southern parts of the Yemen. But take into account that this also means that they do not want to escalate the situation. But still, you have to show, you have to take into account in all you are dealing with these tyrant forces, the forces of aggression, the United States, Israel, the Saudis, the Emirates, every country that sees any weakness on your side when it comes to they will launch more aggressions against you. So all the time you have to tell them that you are understanding, you see what is happening. You have to tell them that you are very strong in order to deter any aggression from being launched by them. So all these steps come in this milieu, if you will. But still, you have to take into account also that there are certain mediations that are taking place. The Omanis on the one side, maybe some other behind the curtain mediations that are taking place that we do not know about. What you can tell is that both parties got a little bit tired of the conflict. So the Yemenis are more steadfast because they are fighting for a right cause, because it's their land that they are fighting. It is their free decision and being an independent state that this is what they are fighting for. Whereas the aggression forces are coming out of greed and in order to exercise hegemony
here where the devil comes dancing in, Mr. Mohammed, because we now read reports coming out of Yemen, especially out of the government in Sana'a, saying that and warning of Saudi, Emirati, and American plans to transfer the battle towards the Yemeni interior into an actual Yemeni civil war instead of Yemenis defending their land against the coalition of aggression by supporting the aggression forces with heavy and modern weapons and drones. And even Washington has allegedly provided great support to the militias on the western coast of Yemen to push for an escalation. And we even read reports about U.S. boots on the ground at the Strait of Bab Mandeb in Yemen. Is that a pretext for U.S. boots on the actual lands, maybe on the shores of Hudaydah?
Well, first of all, let's take, personally, I rule out this possibility, because the Americans are seeking to come out of all the basic conflicts. They do not want to engage directly. This is the case in Ukraine and in China. Whenever they can use their tools on the ground to achieve their goal. You have also to take into account and keep in mind that this conflict is a U.S.-led aggression by the hands and the tools of the Saudis and their militias and the Emirates on the ground. But still, the Americans, personally, I don't think that it is possible for them to engage in any conflict that would take coffins back to Washington and to the other states in the United States. Now, as for the plans to do this, the fact that the Yemeni government in Sana'a is able to expose all these plans and to talk about them, this is a way of deterring this from happening. But still, you have also in order to come to peace or in order to achieve peace, you have to show force, you have to express that knowledge about all the plans of the enemy. You have to tell them that you are ready to confront all their plans, but still all has to come, whatever is to be expected has to do with the how much the Saudis and the Emirates are ready to take back.
Definitely. This new year, 2023, will be a decisive one for Yemen. Everyone is talking about this, whether in the coalition of aggression or inside of Yemen. And it seems that Yemen, the steadfastness of its people, will bring the victory that it deserves. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed Abed, political commentator, for joining us to talk about the latest inside of Yemen. Thank you for being loyal as ever. We'll see you again next week. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. School of Soleimani. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As we approach the anniversary of martyrdom of the great anti-terror general and Commander of Hearts, Qasem Soleimani, we have prepared a five-part series to commemorate this unmatched general. Stay tuned for the second part. This episode will be dedicated to General Soleimani's role in the 8-year Holy Defense. The former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein of the minority Ba'ath Party started the invasion of the Iranian soil in 1980 with the green light of the Western regimes, especially the U.S. While he thought of taking Khuzestan province in 3 days and capturing Tehran in 2 weeks, he faced the youth who resisted their country and the Islamic Revolution valiantly and selflessly. They stood against Saddam's armed-to-the-teeth invading army with bare hands. Haj Qasem Soleimani was one of these brave youths. The great commander writes in his autobiography, "In the first days of going to the front, I considered the enemy able to do anything. But as we carried out the first attack, we succeeded to push back the enemy forces from Susangird Road up to the Hamidiye. This removed the faults of the enemy from my mind. Qasem Soleimani, like other brave commanders of the Holy Defense, had grown up in the spiritual atmosphere spread by the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. The Imam would do everything only for God's sake. He would put his trust in God and was the humble servant of God. Martyr Soleimani was the student of Imam Khomeini's spiritual school. Abbas Qutbuddini, one of the frogmen of Sarallah 41 Division of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, says, "We were getting prepared for an operation. Haj Qasem came to see the group. He told the trainer to choose one of the forces to see his skill. The trainer told me, 'Go inside water, but take care not to mess up in front of Haj Qasem.' The water was cold. When I came out, Haj Qasem encouraged me, but I didn't understand why he was upset and frowning. A few minutes later, when I went to him and asked him if I had done any mistake, he smiled at me and said, 'Brother, I am no one to tell you to die for me. When you wear the frogman suit, know that God is present and sing and say in your heart, I don't do anything except for God's satisfaction. I die for God and I ask him martyrdom. Whenever and wherever you live, consider God's satisfaction as a priority.'" Haj Qasem Soleimani was the commander of the IRGC Sarallah 41 Division during the 8-year imposed war. This division was a brigade in the beginning, and many of his forces had been martyred in the first days of the war. Qasem Soleimani formed the first corps of the brigade in 1981 with a few experienced forces. After 1 year, the brigade increased to 3 brigades and an armored battalion to form a division. Martyr Soleimani's forces were famous for breaking the lines of the enemy. He was very careful in picking commanders. One of the most memorable pages of the honorable history of the Holy Defense was Karbala 5 operation. Lieutenant General Soleimani writes on the operation, "If I say that on the day of Karbala 5 operation, another Karbala took place beside Imam Hussein's Karbala, and all those sacrifices, selflessness, and values that had been shown by Imam Hussein's companions happened during this operation, I have not said an idle talk. We had bright and great figures among ourselves, each of whom we miss. They were the persons who were sitting in the trenches, either reciting the Quran, praying, or writing their last will. They were certainly welcoming death." Karbala 5 operation was one of the fateful battles of the Holy Defense. Saddam had increased more than 10 times his military organization. He had provided the army with state-of-the-art weapons and equipment. The enemy had nearly 5,000 tanks and 4,000 personnel carriers. They had AWACS spying aircrafts and radar systems, which could detect forces according to their temperature. Thus, the detection of the operation was very easy for the enemy. Martyr Soleimani says, "When I refer to that period, I feel that neither that valor, nor that thought, nor those persons belong to this terrestrial world. God created those sins, and it was His will which ruled and created that atmosphere." Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani continues in his autobiography, "One of the features of our war that removed asymmetries were the initiatives which occurred on the scene of the holy defense. The difference between us and the classic armies in the world, besides the spiritual and behavioral issues, was the difference between come and go. Our commander would stand in front and say, 'Come,' but the classic commander would stand at the back saying, 'Go.' Standing in front and saying 'come' has great effects and created great sacrifices. Therefore, the number of our martyred commanders is not comparable with any war. During the imposed war, out of the 12 new founded IRGC divisions, 7 commanders were martyred. Nearly 80% of the battalion commanders were martyred. Had there not been the breaking of lines and standing in front, this would not have happened. When a commander said 'come,' the role of that commander was like a queen bee. Thus, all bees would gather around her."
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
After the disintegration of the Soviet Union, Western countries under the leadership of the U.S. placed the re-engineering of West Asia at the top of their agenda in order to ensure the safety of the Zionist regime and protect their ulterior motives. One aspect of this project was to reshape geographical borders by disintegrating Islamic countries. Accordingly, the multifaceted project to create terrorist anti-Takfiri groups such as Al-Qaeda and Daesh was carried out with the assistance of Saudi Arabia and the Zionist regime, just to name a few of cohorts. As part of this plan, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. But by 2007, the Bush administration concluded that their approach was failing and decided to deploy an additional 30,000 troops to Iraq. During the troop surge operation, General David Petraeus, who commanded U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan, received a letter saying, "General Petraeus, you should know and consider the fact that I, Qasem Soleimani, control the policy for Iran when it comes to Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Gaza, and Afghanistan." The role General Qasem Soleimani played in those countries and beyond before his assassination by Trump orders was to bring honor, pride, dignity, sovereignty, and freedom back to the people. In Iraq and Syria, he spearheaded the fight against the most brutal, lethal, and sophisticated of terrorist groups to date, Daesh and Nusra Front, among others. Takfiri groups that people in Iraq and Syria accuse America of creating, arming, and supporting, and some kingdoms in the Persian Gulf of funding with billions of dollars. To take a closer look at the third anniversary of U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani, the legend, please join us on this edition of Iran Today. In response to regional threats, General Soleimani developed the regional security theory due to his unique understanding of the Western politics and with the purpose of preventing their plot from being fulfilled. On the basis of this theory, it is understood that the security of West Asian Islamic countries is interconnected and influences one another. In other words, any threat to Syria would undermine Iraq's security, and insecurity in Iraq would jeopardize Iranian security, etc.
What distinguishes General Soleimani from others is that he had the power to bring about such a change and revolution in one person that he or she shows a completely new personality. He has the ability of creating new individuals. He has the power of organizing a system. General Soleimani enjoys all the behavioral characteristics of a top leader. The difference between a leader and a manager is that a manager may only focus on the area of his or her responsibilities, while a leader is never limited to one area. General Soleimani could see far horizons of the region. He had the foresight and the ability to see facts and realities that ordinary people may not be able to understand.
So to ensure the West Asian security and counteract Westerners' plots, General Soleimani developed the resistance model and molded the fight against extremism and terrorism on the basis of developing the resistance strategy. In fact, Haj Qasem preempted the Westerners' plans. They were trying to create discord among the Muslims, but General Soleimani united Muslim nations under the basis of resistance. Haj Qasem's miracle was that he placed seven nationalities: the Syrians, Lebanese, the Iranians, Pakistanis, Afghans, and Iraqis under the umbrella of resistance.
General Soleimani was the embodiment of kindness and courage. That is, he had everything. Usually when people have a good characteristic, they can only be successful in that direction. But in the case of Haj Qasem, it should be noted that he had all the good characteristics that are usually seen in a religious person. I had many meetings with him, and I remember that in my first visit, I expected to see a rough political, military figure. Well, he was a soldier, you can't expect otherwise. But I was wrong. The gentleness of his soul attracted me, and I was really fascinated by him.
He shaped this resistance bloc by preserving the native identity and culture of every nation and by not imposing Iranian culture on them. Hezbollah was created with the Lebanese identity, Hashd al-Shaabi with the Iraqi personality, and the Zainabiyun, Fatimiyun, and Haydariyun forces with their own respective national and local characters. And then all of them took advantage of the resulting synergy. For this reason, today, no factor can eliminate these forces, and their power of influence will grow constantly and sustainably.
All the countries of the world are formed and established on the basis of the Western nation-state model. Unlike other countries, the Islamic Republic of Iran was formed on two foundations due to its Islamic nature. One is the same nation-state, and the other is the Ummah state. When it comes to Ummah, borders are disregarded, and nations of several states come under the umbrella of one Ummah, that is the Islamic Ummah. The most important organization that was formed based on this idea is the Quds Army. The Quds Force has no mission inside Iran, but its mission is outside the borders to help the Islamic Ummah. That is why we see the presence of the Quds forces in Lebanon in resistance against the occupation of the Zionist regime. We see it helping Bosnia Muslims against the Srebrenica massacre. We see it helping Syria against Takfiri groups. Now, General Soleimani was the head of this Quds force. In my opinion, he was very successful in carrying out this mission, in defining it and identifying the scope of this mission.
Haj Qasem's goal was to defend Sunni, Shia, Palestinian, Lebanese, Yemeni, Yazidi, Christian, and all the regional people in the Abrahamic religions. So his vision was how to liberate the region and remove the enemy from West Asia. Indeed, he wasn't just an individual, but a doctrine. And this doctrine cannot be destroyed by terror or missiles. The doctrine stays, the doctrine goes on. And Iranians, along with the other folks in the region, will open a new chapter, with many eager to continue Commander Soleimani's legacy.
You see our military and defensive strength today. America is worried about Iran's military growth. Global arrogance, with all its arsenals and weapons and its military advances, still expresses concern. This was while we didn't even have barbed wire at the beginning of the Iraq-Iran war, and no country in the world helped us. Today, we send satellites into the space. We send living creatures into the space. With regard to the growth of science to this day, we have made unprecedented progress. It is not fair to ignore all these positive aspects of Iran. In any case, today we have economic problems. It cannot be denied. But you should also see the progress.
The U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani was a major, dangerous, and unexpected escalation in antagonism between Washington and Tehran. Haj Qasem was perceived by many to be untouchable due to his prominence in Iran and beyond. No one is certain what the short or long-term consequences of his martyrdom will be, except that it will stimulate a soul-deep desire among his many followers to avenge his death.
General Soleimani was one of the greatest legends in terms of establishing security in the region. He was the one who defeated Daesh in Syria and Takfir terrorist movements in Iraq. The same holds true about in Lebanon. If it wasn't for General Soleimani, I think the region would have been insecure for several decades. The West announced that it created Daesh by its own hands, and it reassured that destroying Daesh would take at least 3 to 4 decades. But the presence and efforts of General Soleimani changed everything, as this plague was wiped off the face of the earth much sooner. Today, you can only see a few traces of this terrorist group in the region.
Haj Qasem was assassinated by a U.S. airstrike ordered by former U.S. President Donald Trump at Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. Soleimani and Iraqi military officials were leaving Baghdad airport in two cars when they were hit by a U.S. drone strike near a cargo area. The commander had flown in from Syria on an official trip. Several missiles struck the convoy and at least 7 people died in the incident. Iraqi militia leader Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis was among those killed. Iran's foreign minister at the time, Javad Zarif, called the attack an act of international terrorism, tweeting that the U.S. bears responsibility for all consequences of its rogue adventurism. On January 8, 2020, in a military operation codenamed Operation Martyr Soleimani, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps launched over 12 ballistic missiles at the Ain al-Assad airbase in western Iraq, as well as another airbase in Erbil in response to the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani by a United States drone strike 5 days earlier. The strike was the largest ballistic missile attack ever against American forces. Initially, the U.S. was not willing to concede the seriousness of the attack. While some U.S. officials assessed that none of its service members were injured or killed, the U.S. Department of Defense ultimately said that 110 service members had been diagnosed and treated for traumatic brain injuries from the attack.
A few months before the martyrdom of General Soleimani, we read in several articles that he was considered one of the world's top military security theorists. Indeed, in the 33-day war in Lebanon, his presence made the occupying regime of Israel to feel and experience the bitter taste of defeat for the first time. Also, in the Gaza 22-day war, the world was witness to the key role of Qasem Soleimani. Later, we saw that the number of days that Israel dared to attack decreased to 11 days and then to a week and even less. You don't have to be a military analyst to understand that there is not balance of power between Hezbollah and Israel, but despite the fact that the Zionist regime of Israel was armed to the teeth, but General Soleimani's military genius and experience changed the outcome of the wars. He managed to overcome the enemy despite all the support it received from the U.S. government.
General Soleimani's assassination plots the prompt and effective action of the armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran reportedly upset the geopolitical equations to the point that it brought about the definite failure of U.S. regional strategy. The U.S. fleeing from Afghanistan, the beginning of the process of withdrawal from Iraq, and the change in the strategy of the U.S. military presence in the geostrategic region of Persian Gulf is indicative of such impacts and consequences. Undoubtedly, the criminal act of the United States in martyring General Soleimani is a clear manifestation of a terrorist attack that was orchestrated and carried out in an organized manner by the then U.S. government, for which the current Biden administration in the White House is also responsible.
First of all, General Soleimani had special characteristics. He helped both in creating the resistance movement and also cultivated an intimate relationship with its leaders. In terms of the aspects of the plan devised by him, they succeeded in creating a movement that brought a lot of credit for the Islamic Republic of Iran regarding its international relations and the sphere of its influence. His military genius, his personal relationships, and the type of organization he created in the region are perhaps the three greatest characteristics of Martyr Soleimani.
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Islamic Republic has adopted a number of measures from the time of the assassination based on legal principles of combating the impunity of criminals to hold such individuals and entities accountable before the courts and will continue on this path until the final result is achieved. To fight impunity means that international and national criminal law establishes that certain crimes are not subject to any statute of limitations, ensuring that the most severe crimes do not go unpunished.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media. Here's how it looks on the page. People's Dispatch says lawsuit filed in Iraq against Trump aids for assassination of Qasem Soleimani and al-Muhandis. Soleimani and Muhandis were key figures in the fight against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. They were assassinated in a drone attack on January 3, 2020, ordered by former U.S. President Donald Trump. Almost 2 years after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad, at least 78 Iraqis filed a lawsuit in an Iraqi court on Sunday, November 27, against then-U.S. President Donald Trump and other officials of his administration. The plaintiffs demanded legal action against the accused, including Trump and his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, among others, in their petition filed at Baghdad's Federal Court of Appeal. The plaintiffs include the brother of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, Muhammad Hassan Jafar al-Muhandis. Both Soleimani and Muhandis were celebrated in Iraq and Iran for playing key roles in fighting against the Islamic State ISIS and reversing its advances. Prior to its defeat, ISIS had taken control over a large part of Iraq and Syria. The assassinations invited a strong reaction from Iran and mass protests in both Iran and Iraq. Within a couple of days, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution asking the government to ensure that all foreign troops leave the country. In April this year, U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price admitted that the intensity and frequency of attacks on foreign troops in Iraq increased following the U.S. assassination of Soleimani and Muhandis. He noted that between 2018 and 2020, attacks on U.S. forces increased by 400%. The cradle reads, former Iraqi prime minister under U.S. protection faces arrest for Soleimani assassination. Iraqi lawmakers are considering arresting former Iraqi prime minister Mustafa al-Kazemi for his alleged role in the assassination of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. in 2020. During an interview with Iraqi news outlet Shafaq News on 12 December, a senior official in the State of Law Coalition, Fazel al-Zarghawi, revealed lawmakers are mulling over the decision. He also claimed al-Kazemi is being sheltered inside the U.S. embassy. The available information confirms that al-Kazemi is in the capital, Baghdad, and has not left the country. He is inside the green zone and is sheltering in the American embassy, Zarghawi said on Monday. He then added, the next stage will witness the issuance of arrest warrants and investigations against al-Kazemi for his involvement in the theft of the century case and the assassination of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and Qasem Soleimani. Sardar Soleimani was a strong thread of unity and adherence to the ideals of the Islamic Revolution, independence, and Iranian identity. He believed in the ideals of Imam Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Republic. Imam believed in a neither East nor West policy for the country. He considered the country's progress to be the result of independence from the foreign powers.
It is possible that a lot of our wealth and facilities have been spent for curbing the conspiracies against the country. If this money had been spent on the welfare and comfort of the nation, the situation would have been much better, undoubtedly. Just look at the costs imposed by some deviant and anti-Iran groups on the government of Iran. Well, I have been in Kurdistan and seen these groups are provoked and take actions against Iran, which literally waste the energy of the government. Don't forget the costs of the war imposed by Iraq also. If these had not happened, if the sanctions were not in place after all the negotiations, then we would have definitely seen progress in Iran. Of course, despite all the hardships, restrictions and sanctions, the progress brought by the Islamic Republic is not seen in the history of this country. Of course, despite all the hardships and restrictions and sanctions, the progress brought by the Islamic Republic in Iran is not seen in the history of this country.
The revolution of Iran was completely a popular movement through which the Imam revived Islam in the country. It was founded on the Islamic values such as supporting the oppressed and treating the rich and the poor, the rural and the urban and others with the same eye.
Whether the ideals of the 1979 Islamic Revolution have been realized or not, in my opinion, this question is not easy to answer. These ideals consist of a wide range of demands, which can be summarized in a short, comprehensive phrase, and that is social justice. If we want to go more into details, ideals such as prosperity, freedom, independence, self-confidence, self-belief, and equality are the prominent ones which I can safely assume that have been realized. To sum it up, we need to be fair in our judgment on the performance of the Islamic government of Iran. We have gained the principle of social justice to a great extent. Although there is still a long way ahead of us, but the pivotal point here is that the government has long started treading on this path and it will accomplish this responsibility.
One of the main ideals of the Islamic Republic has always been to help the subjugated countries in the region and support the revolutionary cause in other parts of the world. Accordingly, the issue of Palestine and its importance in the Islamic world was first proposed by Imam Khomeini and then presented to the complex world of politics. General Qasem Soleimani, who understood its importance from the time he understood the Khomeini movement, never let it out of sight and accepted it as a defined ideology. He always stood by the side of Palestinians in various forms, including in ideology and solidarity, and also in providing them with equipment.
Contrary to what many people think, the Quds force is not just a military organization. Its activities cover military, cultural, and political areas, and diplomatic relations are both part of its principles. General Soleimani was successful in many cases without firing a single shot. This goes back to the deterrent power it created and many other issues. So yes, he was a diplomat, a soldier, and a politician.
Haj Qasem Soleimani sought to elevate the Islamic Revolution and considered Iran as a sanctuary. He regarded Iran to be like a holy shrine, that if it falls in harm's way, many other holy shrines will be harmed consequently. He was both a national hero and a hero to the Islamic Ummah and will remain that way. He has become a role model for free-thinking people until eternity.
I believe that Mr. Soleimani was the architect of resistance. Imam Khomeini was the architect of the Islamic Revolution, and Ayatollah Khamenei is the second architect of the revolution, but here Mr. Soleimani was the architect of the resistance movement. In other words, he created a mechanism that works for everyone, despite all differences they may have in religious and political areas. His followers come from various and sometimes contradictory religious and political backgrounds, but General Soleimani managed to organize and mobilize all of them for a common goal.
General Soleimani's funeral processions in the capital city of Tehran came days after hundreds of thousands of mourners accompanied the coffin carrying his remains in the cities of Qadhim, Najaf, Karbala in Iraq, and Ahvaz and Mashhad in Iran. The multi-city ceremony continued after Tehran, with Martyr Soleimani's remains going to the holy city of Qom before his burial ceremony was held in his hometown of Kerman.
God willing, the roots of the global arrogance that is the U.S. government will be removed from this region soon. The world was witness to the martyrdom of General Soleimani and the fact that the U.S. government cowardly assassinated him by a drone. It was very sad. The country, which pretends to be an advocate of the fight against terrorism, killed the man who was at the forefront of the fight against terrorism. In fact, one of the reasons that General Soleimani was on the right path and was a good person is that he was assassinated by the most evil and satanic government on earth. His funeral is another proof that documents disclaim. The unique and wide attendance of people at his funeral was unparalleled. We can only compare it to Imam Khomeini's funeral, the founder of the Islamic Revolution of 1979. General Soleimani's funeral, however, was not limited to Tehran or even Iran only. People of Iraq paid their respect to his body in their own country. His body was also transferred to several Iranian provinces, such as Khuzestan, Mashhad, and Kerman.
Various Iranian and international leaders joined the massive crowds in the funeral processions of the legendary commander, held in many other places across the world.
After the funeral of General Soleimani, one of Iraq's high-ranking officials told me that he was shocked and amazed to see the large presence of Iraqi people and their respect for an Iranian commander. The then president of Iraq, Mr. Barham Saleh, also admitted that he was really shocked and surprised by the funeral and the warm and glorious welcome of the Iraqi people to General Soleimani and Iran. This shows the support of the Iraqi nation for the Iranian government and people.
But in Tehran, in freezing early morning temperatures, women dressed in black walked alongside men holding up flags bearing the names of Shia imams as they walked down Revolution Street in capital towards the Tehran University. A several million strong turnout had poured onto the streets of the city to pay respects to Qasem Soleimani, the country's most powerful, beloved military commander. Iranians appeared saddened and very angry at the way he was killed. They felt that this was a very unjust act the way it was carried out. Iran's local media reported that the streets of the capital were so full of mourners that many were unable to emerge from underground metro stations. Addressing the huge crowd, Haj Qasem's daughter, Zainab, said the U.S. and its ally, Israel, faced a dark day for her father's assassination. "Crazy Trump, don't you think that everything is over with my father's martyrdom?" she said, referring to the former U.S. president. The families of U.S. soldiers in the Middle East will spend their days waiting for the death of their children, she said to Cheers. Brigadier General Ismail Qaani, General Soleimani's successor, also reminded the crowd that the only compensation for us would be to remove America from the region. That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Do tune in same time next week and each week after. And don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.